So Northern Irish poetry has long been renowned for the representation and interrogation of political violence. Throughout the 25 years of the Troubles, a number of writers used their craft as a way of making sense of much of the traumatic nature of Northern Irish experience. For the critic Fran Brereton, the Troubles raised the stakes for Northern Irish art, casting the poet in the role of truth-teller and first-hand witness. And I think, as we've seen over the last 2 days, those two concepts are really important when it comes to thinking about post-conflict literature. Within existing accounts, the tendency has been to read the literature of the Troubles as a foil to the more antagonistic and divisive aspects of Northern Irish politics. As early as 1970, the Northern Irish poet Derek Mahan would suggest that a good poem is a paradigm of good politics. For Mahan, the orderly, structured, and nuanced aspects of poetry had exemplary value when it came to the more closed-off, narrow-minded, and reactionary elements of the Northern Irish political psyche. In the early 1990s, the critic Edna Longley would assume a similar tone, describing Northern Irish writing as a form of cultural corridor, a fluid and transgressive space, a locus of productive ambiguity in which the ideological certainties of nationalism and unionism, Irishness and Britishness, might be reimagined and realigned. And Northern Ireland's most famous literary son, Seamus Heaney, would give these sentiments his own inflection in arguing that, quote, the subtleties and tolerances, end quote, of poetry were themselves an implicit and occasionally explicit reprimand to what he called the coarseness and intolerances of Northern Irish public life. And as we've heard, Northern Ireland, of course, changed radically in the 1990s with the country slowly awakening from the nightmare of its recent history. 1994 saw ceasefires by both Republican and Loyalist paramilitaries, a peace process, and the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. After a protracted and sometimes difficult labour, Northern Ireland gave birth to a power-sharing executive in which former enemies took up the reins of devolved self-governance in the form of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Writing back in 1994, at the dawn of this new era, the journalist Francine Cunningham would ask, now that the ceasefires have been announced, what will happen to all the Northern Irish writers? Where will they go for their material? This is a useful provocation with which to begin, I think. Though it's worth pointing out that Cunningham makes a couple of false assumptions about the Northern Irish literary landscape. Her first mistake is to offer a highly reductive model of Northern Irish literature, equating it in its entirety with writing about the Troubles. Her second mistake is to assume that the silencing of the guns would somehow be capable of drawing a line under both long-standing political grievances and the deeply traumatic nature of Northern Ireland's recent past. And I guess my paper is an argument that neither of these things have really happened. Far from falling into irrelevance, I want to argue that poetry has remained vital to artistic attempts to make sense of the radical transformations that have in recent years characterized Northern Irish society. One example of this is offered by the American critic Richard Rankin Russell, who in his recent book Poetry and Peace outlines what he calls a reconciliatory aesthetic in the work of Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley, a thematic current that prefigured and in some senses underpinned the kind of creative solutions that became the hallmark of the Good Friday Agreement. And really what Russell's offering here is a more detailed working out of a view by the preeminent Irish critic Declan Kybird. And Kybird argued that the seeds of the Belfast Agreement were sown in the works of Irish literature, a claim he supports by the view that much of the language of the Belfast Agreement is vague and even poetic in nature. So again, Eamon mentioned the deliberate productive ambiguity that was in the agreement. And for some people, that was a cause for concern and criticism because it created uncertainty. But actually, other people have argued that it was that degree of ambiguity that allowed people to sit at the same table and to be in the same room and to live with that ambiguity for a period of time. So it had a positive effect. So if poetry has been a vital discursive space in which to analyse both the Troubles and the peace process, then what about the aftermath of the Northern Irish conflict? How might poetry contribute to the process of understanding the legacy of the Troubles? And what happens when we submit notions about truth and reconciliation and post-traumatic memory to the rigours of poetic form? I'm going to begin trying to answer these questions by looking at the work of two poets, one you will have heard of and one you probably haven't. One is a Nobel Prize winner and the other is not. should say not yet. Al would like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them we might think of as a Troubles poet, and the other one I think we might think of as a post-Troubles poet. They are, of course, Seamus Heaney and Alan Gillis. I want to begin with what in recent years have become arguably the most quoted lines in the whole of the Heaney canon, a verse that comes from The Curate Troy, Heaney's 1990 adaptation of the Sophoclean tragedy Philostates. The lines have been publicly evoked by everyone from the President of the United States to the President of Sinn Féin. I want to suggest that such appropriations, despite testifying to the value of poetry, risk simplifying Heaney's aesthetic vision, opening it up to accusations of poetic cliché. For me, a careful critical approach to these lines and reading them back in their broader literary context serves to counteract the charge that what poetry offers is really just a set of facile consolations and some easy aesthetic remedies for what, as we've seen, and particularly from Cahill's film, are really deep felt, traumatic memories. I'll use this description of Heaney, or the discussion of Heaney, as a way into the work of Alan Gillis, and in particular his poem Progress. And taken together, I want to argue that these poems offer a highly productive context for thinking about the role of literature in the aftermath of political conflict. They also offer valuable insights into the nature of poetic influence and some of the challenges and opportunities confronting what we might call a post-Troubles generation of Northern Irish poets. So let's begin with the much-quoted lines from The Curate Troy. So it's not number one in your handout, class, but it's on there. So these are the lines. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. The first thing that's worth pointing out is the degree to which these lines have penetrated the public consciousness. On his visit to Northern Ireland in 1995 as part of the peace process, US President Bill Clinton would quote this verse before an assembled crowd in Derry. Clinton would also borrow them for the title of his 1996 book, Between Hope and History. More recently, the lines were quoted by the US Vice President Joe Biden at a memorial service for the Boston bombing in 2013. And again last month in a speech he gave about Israel and Palestine. And as I mentioned, the words also feature in the title of Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams' book about the peace process entitled Hope and History, Making Peace in Ireland. So why have these lines become so popular? To answer this question, we might think about the way this verse offers in microcosm one of the stylistic traits upon which Heaney's success as a poet has been founded. And namely, it's the ability to write a highly accessible poetry in which everyday language and experience are imbued with a sense of the transcendental. And we heard Eamon talk a little bit about Wordsworth being a real important touchstone for Heaney, and I think that's really where a lot of this aesthetic comes from and is lifted from. The stanza combines the elemental with the monumental. And this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, arising like a longed-for tidal wave. Heaney infuses the present with a sense of dramatic importance, a triangulation point for justice, hope, and history. The verse is highly aspirational, elevating the speaker while also carrying an implicit sense of carpe diem. It is the audience's job to harness the potential of such momentary realignment. Heaney's reputation as a lyric poet can be seen in the sonic sense of the stanza, as the pairing of time and rhyme at the end of the third and the sixth lines add a feeling of something accomplished, something fitting and complete. Whilst hope and history, of course, can never literally rhyme, it is through the reconfigurations of the poem that they are allowed to hold one another in a state of harmony and counterbalance. However, I want to suggest that a more complex understanding of Heaney's vision can be grasped by attending to the broader literary context in which this verse occurs. Okay. As I mentioned, these lines are taken from The Curate Troy, Heaney's 1990 adaptation of the Sophocles play Philostates. And again, it's interesting to remember that the play is a tragedy, and also that the verse is meant to be spoken by the chorus in the play. So it's not the same as Heaney the poet speaking, in his own lyric poetic voice. So there's a degree of freedom and a kind of, the public voice coming through in that makes it slightly different from some of the other Heaney that we might read. As many of you will know, the play is about the Trojan Wars and tells the story of Philoctetes, a Greek soldier who is wounded after being bitten on the foot by a snake. The wound causes Philoctetes constant agony, gives off a horrible smell, and so his comrades, led by the wily Odysseus, abandon him on the Greek island of Lemnos. 10 years later, the Greeks learn that they need Philoctetes' bow, left to him by Hercules, in order to win the Trojan War. Odysseus goes back to Lemnos, accompanied by Neoptolemus, the son of Achilles, to try and trick Philoctetes and secure the bow. Understandably, Philoctetes isn't best pleased at this, and when he learns of the plan, refuses to cooperate. Neoptolemus is caught between his individual conscience, wanting to do the right thing by Philoctetes, and his obligations to the Greek cause. In the end, he agrees to take Philoctetes home, knowing he will incur the wrath of his own side, the Greek army. However, as they are leaving Lemnos, the god Heracles appears and tells Philoctetes that if he puts the past behind him and helps the Greeks, then his foot will be healed and his torment ended. Philoctetes obeys him and the play ends. Through the moral struggle of Neoptolemus, Philoctetes becomes a play about the tension between tribal loyalty and an alternative ethics, one premised on a sense of individual responsibility. The festering wound of Philoctetes, combined with his 10-year incarceration, evoke questions of long-term suffering, of blinding and deep-felt wrongs, and of the difficult nature of personal forgiveness. With this in mind, it is worth attending to the verses which surround the much-quoted lines with which we began. And what I thought we would do is look at the chorus in its entirety, you know, those five verses. So let's have a look at that. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. History says, don't hope in this side of the grave. But then once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a farther shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call miracle, self-healing, the utter self-revealing double-take of feeling. If there's fire in the mountain and lightning and storm and a god speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. It means that once in a lifetime, the justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. If you shouldn't follow the leading scholar in your field, then what you should do is quote from one of the best writers of the 20th century. And that's the way that you can hide behind whatever you decide to do. The opening stanza offers a more subtle account, I think, of Heaney's poetic, while also helping us to think about the role of literature in the aftermath of political conflict. If we think about that opening stanza, it opens with three declarative statements which serve as a dramatic setting out of the facts. Human beings suffer, they torture one another, they get hurt and get hard. And again, the soundscape of Heaney's writing is crucial. The doubling of the line length from 3 to 6 syllables, along with the run-on R sounds in suffer and torture and another, imbue the words with a sense of emphatic, declarative truth. The point is hammered home in line 3 with a combination of alliteration and the hard vowel sounds in hurt and hard. As we move into the next line, no poem or play or song can fully right a wrong. The musicality of the language, the alliteration of poem and play, the full rhyme of song and wrong, they hold out the promise of a lyric sweetness, an aesthetic compensation for the traumatic subject which the poem addresses. However, as quickly as this is offered, it is also retracted. It's taken back by the flat, hard endings of inflicted and endured. This sense of proffer and denial, in contrast to the unalloyed transcendentalism of the middle stanza, shows Heaney caught between notions of aesthetic consolation and a much more cautious and circumspect mode of utterance. Such interpretations find support in Brendan Corcoran's view that Heaney aims to generate a productive rather than a palliative art. It also evokes what Fran Brayton has called Heaney's poetics of responsibility, a sense in which the poetry achieves a form of redress, which many of you know is Heaney's own word for what he tries to do with his poetry, and by allowing the reader to more fully comprehend the world. And with this in mind, it's crucial for Heaney that no poem or play or song can fully right a wrong. And it's to the word fully that I would direct our attention here. For if Heaney is suspicious that art can offer us a form of redemption, neither does he wish to have us dismiss it altogether. As Rita Felski argues in her recent book, The Uses of Literature, reading and thinking about literary texts opens us up to new forms of knowledge, providing us with insight and realization, and the kind of realization that remains oblique and hidden within other forms of cultural discourse. Given actually the international kind of scope and the South African component to the symposium, it's probably worth pointing out, as Tony probably realized at the back, is that Nadine Gordimer takes lines from the Heaney poem for her 1999 book, Living in Hope and History, Notes from Our Century. And the other reference point is Mandela, because Heaney was adapting the poem in 1990, not directly on the back of, but Mandela's release from prison had just happened before he was adapting the poem. And in an interview, he says, Sophocles' play seemed to mesh beautifully with Mandela's return. The act of betrayal, and then the generosity of his coming back and helping with the city, helping the polis get back together again. So there's a really nice pairing between Mandela and Philosthetes, you know, imprisoned, abandoned for such a long time, and then, you know, not opting for revenge. The other thing that I think is really interesting that we might pick up in the questions is the appropriation of Greek tragedy. Certainly within Northern Ireland, I know that context quite well, but within South Africa, you know, South African writers that look to Greek tragedy as a reference point and as a way of thinking through. So that's one of the things we might talk about in the questions. So from Seamus Heaney to Alan Gillis, and what we might call a post-Troubles poet. Alan Gillis made his literary debut with the poetry collection Somebody Somewhere, which was published in 2004. And the other interesting thing about Gillis, and Eamon sketched this out for us earlier, was the notion of kind of Yeats at one end and Heaney at the other, and Irish poetry being a poetry about conflict and the whole period in the middle being missed out. Gillis actually wrote his PhD on the poetry of the 1930s and people like Louis MacNeice, who don't sit in that paradigm of poetry and conflict. So I think it's quite an interesting place to think about locating him. So from the book's opening poem, which is called The Ulster Way, there's a sense of, a poet striving to achieve a sense of productive distance from what we might call the rustic imperative of his local literary forebears, Seamus Heaney included. And we can think again about the field as being very important to Heaney and a lot of what, you know, what Heaney thinks about and works through. And let's just read quickly, like, the first verse of Gillis's poem. He says, "This is not about burns or hedges. There will be no gorse. You will not notice the ceaseless photosynthesis or the dead tree's thousand fingers, the trunk's inhumanity writhing with texture, as you will not be passing into farmland." Okay. I'll let you kind of work through the rest of that when you want to. The title of the poem itself, The Ulster Way, is a signal to the ironic negations with which Gillis launches into this collection. And we should remember that Ulster has, after all, long had a reputation as the place that likes to say no. Moreover, Gillis's incantatory riffin is more suggestive of Gil Scott Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised than anything that's recognisably Irish. And the rejection of lanes, hedgerows and farmland can be seen as a deliberate wish to hold a Heaney-esque aesthetic at arm's length, to seek out new landscapes in which to interrogate and chart the quiddity of modern experience. The urban and experimental qualities of the Belfast poet Ciarán Carson are arguably much more apparent in Gillis's verbal pyrotechnics. And Carson was, I guess, kind of a mentor almost to Gillis as he was coming through. I want to suggest, however, that despite this apparent Heaney bashing, the post-conflict context encourages us to consider these two writers alongside one another. And far from being a bugbear for Gillis's project, Heaney's work can be seen as a coda through which to reread and make sense of the younger poet's work. To illustrate this point, I wish to consider another poem from Gillis's debut collection, Progress. The poem itself is explicitly concerned with questions about the past and with the difficulty of coming to terms with the aftermath of political conflict. So this is just a short poem. So let's read this one. Progress. They say that for years Belfast was backwards, and it's great now to see some progress. So I guess we can look forward to taking boxes from the earth. I guess that ambulances will leave the dying back amidst the rubble to be explosively healed. Given time, 100,000 particles of glass will create impossible patterns in the air before coalescing into the clarity of a window, through which a reassembled head will look out and admire the shy young man taking his bomb from the building and driving home. It's a good day. In its title, An Opening Lines, Gillis's poem can be seen to take on the official rhetoric that has accompanied much of the post-agreement era in the North. The poem seeks to expose and undermine those who would resort to banal cliché in order to theorise the aftermath of the Northern Irish conflict. If the poem is a form of weighing in, then it is also an act of weighing up, demanding that we pause and reconsider what we might mean by progress, what it might look like, and how it might be realised amid the emotional and political complexity of the post-Troubles North. The poem's opening lines, with its they say and I guess, initiates a hypothetical test in which the poem then attempts to examine how Belfast's infamous backwardness might be at long last corrected. These lines also disclose Gillis's desire to contrast the insider and the outsider's perspective. The confident assertiveness of the outsider, they say, stands alongside the much more cautious and questioning attitude of the insider, who can only surmise and guess as to what things might mean. And I would also suggest that when you get to the end of the poem, the I guess becomes a quite streetwise, you know, kind of vernacular undoing of this kind of official rhetoric. In this, there are important echoes of Heaney's 1975 poem, Whatever You Say, Say Nothing, and its encounter with, quote, English journalists in search of views on the Irish thing. Unlike the heightened sensitivities of poetic language, the casual indifference of these outside figures, the English journalists, signals at best a lazy disinterest, or more problematically, a deliberate sense of political and moral evasion. In Gillis's poem, the notion that for years Belfast went backwards can be seen to compound this idea, reinstigating long-standing British views about the barbarity of the Irish in contrast to the so-called civilising influence of their colonial masters, a dynamic that Heaney himself refers to in his ironic use of the phrase anachronistic passions when he's written about the Troubles. Gillis's poem takes such optimistic platitudes to task, exposing them as the shortcuts to thinking that they really are. It appropriates the notion of northern backwardness and inverts it, redeploying it through a series of images that attempt to visually undo the carnage of the Troubles. And for people of everybody of a certain generation, I'm not talking to my undergraduates now, imagine the VHS video player when it's playing and you push rewind and you watch it in backwards. You have to do the historical reference when you talk to the 19-year-old. VHS? What is that? Graves will be dug up as boxes are taken from the earth. The dying will be left back amid bomb sites where they will be explosively healed, and the shattered glass will make impossible patterns in the air before coalescing into the clarity of a window. Gillis's iconography becomes more fantastic as the poem advances, gradually revealing that this is the stuff of daydream. As the glass makes impossible patterns, we are reminded of the futility of our desire for a pre-lapsarian north. Such flights of fancy, despite the visual acrobatics and the momentary aesthetic pleasure, lead to a sober conclusion. If there will be progress, it will be without those who have died, without those who were killed, without those who will never come back. The postmodern tricksiness of Gillis's poem ends with a somber and downbeat note. It casts a light back on the cheery optimism of the opening lines and their overeager assertion that it's great now to see some progress. Gillis's poem serves as a cautionary tale, a word of warning against such glib affirmations. Like the Heaney poem before it, it testifies to the impossibility of easy aesthetic consolations. However, again, like the Heaney poem, Gillis's work is not entirely without hope. And progress likewise contains new knowledge, guiding us towards a better understanding of the world with which we are confronted. It reminds us that reconciliation moves at a glacial pace in ways that are difficult and perhaps even impossible to see. In conclusion, I'd like to end with a quote from the American poet Robert Frost. Frost was hugely important to a whole generation of Northern Irish poets during the Troubles, and I think he's still relevant in the context of a post-conflict literature. His 1939 essay, The Figure a Poem Makes, Frost writes, "Poetry ends in a clarification of life, not necessarily a great clarification, such as sects and cults are founded on, but in a momentary stay against confusion." Given the politically complex and emotionally fraught nature of post-conflict peacebuilding, the notion of a momentary stay against confusion perhaps offers a more humble and measured definition of something that we might like to call progress. Thanks.